Ladies and gentlemen, Chairman of Gilder Publishing, George Gilder.
You got to get people in. All right. What? Okay. Can somebody go out and get some of the people in? You, not you, Carver. You got to stay in. This is the high point of the conference that you're missing. This is the climax and consummation that's about to occur. This is the 10th time that Carver Mead has climax telecosm, and each speech has been better than the one before, and delve more profoundly into the nature of the universe. And I've written three books so far about Carver, one called Microcosm that was mostly guided by Carver and brought me into the microcosm, and then the Silicon Eye, which described the project that Carver husbanded that climaxed with the foveon chip, but also explored the nature of vision and the mind. And now I've written a book mostly about comparing Carver beginning as an engineer and ending as a physicist and philosopher. And Feynman, who came to Caltech almost at the same time and began as a physicist and passed through philosophy into engineering at Thinking Machines at the end, and trying to grasp the nature of engineering and physics and science, which Carver epitomizes and will epitomize for us this evening. Thank you so much, Carver.
Thanks, George. It's been very interesting the last 10 years. Telecosm has sort of been the place where I get a window on what's happening in the real world. Most of the time I spend sort of in my own imagination, so it's good to hear what everyone else is doing. And of course, the telecosm the last 2 days has been very different from the first telecosm. And I was reflecting on those differences. The whole tenor is completely different. A number of threads ran through this telecosm. You all saw them, of course. One of the threads was power that never got mentioned in the first telecosm and is coming to be increasingly a word that appears along with other metrics of performance. That was interesting. So that led me to think back a little bit, and I think maybe on the 10th anniversary of telecosm I could be forgiven for a little retrospection. So let me just tell you some stories. I got my PhD in 1959, and I liked the research community and I liked the students, and so I stayed on and continued teaching. And I had been fascinated by the physics of electrons ever since I can remember. When I was a small child, Benjamin Franklin was my hero. And So here I was working away on some of my research, and this guy waltzed into my office, first year I've been teaching. He said, "Hi, I'm Gordon Moore from Fairchild. What are you doing?" Oh, okay. I'd heard of Fairchild, I hadn't heard of Gordon Moore. So I told him a little about the work I was doing on electron tunneling, and we got to chatting, and he invited me to come up to Silicon Valley at this new little company, Fairchild, and give a talk and get to meet the people, which I did. And that started my 40 years of commuting back and forth between Caltech and Southern California and Silicon Valley, and went through the evolution of what we now call the silicon or semiconductor business and a bunch of what we call information technology. And in the beginning, it was very interesting working with Gordon. On one of my typical consulting trips, I'd come in early morning and Gordon would be there and we'd talk for half an hour about what was going on in the research lab, which he was running at the time. And then I'd go out and spend my day with the people doing the real work and find out what was going on. And in the evening, along about 5 o'clock, I'd come back and I'd spend another hour with Gordon. And in 1965, Gordon had just started making his plots, where he would plot the logarithm of the number of transistors on a chip as a function of the year. They're little hand-drawn plots. I still have some around. And one day we were talking about his plots, and he said, "Yeah, you're working on electron tunneling. That happens when things get really small, right?" "Yeah, that was right." I said, "Well, wouldn't that limit how small you could make a transistor?" "Yes." "Well, how small is that?" Gordon has a way of asking these very simple questions that you really think you should know the answer to. And I didn't. So I said, "Well, I'll have to go think about it." Well, I've been thinking about it ever since. So I went off and started thinking about it. It isn't quite as simple as it sounds, but there is one simple way you can think about it. And about a year later, there was a thing called the it was some IEEE workshop on electron devices. I forget, it had a little acronym. The acronyms weren't as long then, and there weren't as many of them then. And I was supposed to give a talk, and I thought, well, this would really be a good thing to talk about. It sort of get me to think about it. So I started thinking about it. And there was a stupid, simple way of thinking about it, and then there was the complicated one, which it took us another year to figure out, or two more years to figure out. But the simple way to think about it is that you have a device like an MOS transistor, and it has some dimension. And the way MOS transistors work, you all know, they have a channel where the electrons go, and then they have a gate that's separated by an insulating layer, and that gate changes the potential that the electrons have to go through and therefore changes the rate at which the electrons will go through. And all of this stuff that you've been seeing here has those little guys in them. So all semiconductor processes have this thing, I think you called it F, the feature size. And everything sort of scaled to that. So I asked the question, suppose you scaled everything by just the same factor. So you made it half as long, half as wide, half as thick. Just scale everything down. Does that work? Well, yes. it works, but only if you also scale a voltage down. Because the things that cause electrons to leak away from the gate and from the electrodes of the transistor are all related to the electric field, and that electric field is related to the voltage you put on the device. So if you're going to make this simple argument, you have to scale the voltage with the feature size. You make the device half as long, half as wide, half as thick, and half the voltage. And if you do that, a very, very remarkable thing happens. And I had to do this over again about 100 times before I gave this talk because I couldn't believe it. And it's easy enough to work out. The actual energy that it takes to switch one of these devices goes down like the cube, the third power of this feature size. That's really interesting, because what that means is, the time it takes to switch one of these devices, which is just related to how long it takes an electron to get from one side to the other of these simple multiples of that number, that time goes like the feature size. So you make the device half the size, it runs twice as fast, takes 1/8 of the energy, and there's four times as many of them. So if you run them at the maximum rate, the whole thing has 8 times the computing power, and it has the same power dissipation per unit area of silicon. Now, if there's ever been a violation of Murphy's Law, was this one. I mean, it gets faster, it gets lower power, it gets hugely more effective in its use of energy to do computation, and it doesn't melt. So I gave this talk, and there was an enormous brouhaha about that, because everybody knew that couldn't be right. I mean, Murphy has never been foiled before, and he's not going to get foiled this time. So they had all of their reasons. So that was a tough year, but the next year, quite a number of them had their own version of this scaling thing and ended up with about the same conclusions. So that was really interesting. So then, of course, Gordon Moore started his campaign of, you know, the devices, we're making more transistors, they're getting cheaper per transistor, this is good for the world, it's good for freedom and apple pie in America and all the good things. And Gordon, this is the 40th anniversary of, it's not just the 10th anniversary of Telecosm, it's the 40th anniversary of Moore's Law, so I've been going around the country with Gordon and, you know, helping people to heap accolades on Gordon, which he richly deserves. And so I've had some chance to chat with him. And Gordon always saw this as a matter of manufacturing economics. And it is. But the reason people were upset in the beginning had nothing to do with manufacturing. It's because they didn't believe it could happen for fundamental reasons. So I didn't see it as a manufacturing economics thing. I saw it as a, is it physically feasible? Is it possible within the laws of physics as we know them and the limitations of the materials as we know them to actually pull this thing off? And I was able to convince myself that it was, and gradually convince other people that it was. So we ended up with this synergetic relationship where I would send Gordon little things about physics, and he would send me his latest plot, which had another point on it of some integrated circuit that had more transistors on it. So that was interesting. That was an interesting period. It ended up that pretty much everybody figured out that that was a good thing. And they forgot one little part of it. And that is that if you want the physics to stay there, you really do have to scale a voltage down as you scale the feature sizes. You don't have to do it exactly linearly, and you can work out. But the industry has never scaled the voltages down as fast as they've scaled the feature sizes down, which meant that the power dissipation per unit area of the devices have gone up. And you've seen some humorous plots of linear extrapolations of the current trends where the chips get the temperature of the surface of the sun in 2010 or whatever it is. And we all know that's not going to happen. But it does bring up an important point, and that is that we haven't been scaling things in a sustainable way. And so our power dissipations are beginning way out of hand. And this telecosm is the first time I've heard people say, as if it were common knowledge, that this doesn't make sense. It's very interesting. I had been thinking about this thing as the 60s went by, and by the time we got in the early 70s, I wrote a little article for our local Caltech rag, and had some interesting things in it. One thing I said was that these integrated circuits were going to grow in complexity and capability, and they were going to be in everything. And the examples I used, I said they're going to be in your typewriter. Those were the days of the Selectric typewriter. That was an advanced state of the art. They were going to be in your telephone. They were going to be in your toaster. And that was interesting because everybody thought this was just, you know, fluff. The other thing I said was that as the complexity grew, the way we were going to get more computing wasn't to just keep making the clock run faster, but we were going to get more things working in parallel. And I heard this said several times in this conference as if everyone had always understood this. So let me just say three words about why that's a good idea. Anytime you have a functional thing like a memory or x86, since that's the only processor anymore, we've been told, and or some object like that, and you go through a cycle of its operation, you use some fraction of the transistors in that device. And the bigger that device, typically the smaller fraction of transistors you use. Easy to see that. In a memory, you read out one row. So if you have an n by n thing, as you make n bigger, the fraction of transistors you get to use on any given cycle goes down by that factor of n. Same thing's true of a processor. And yeah, you can help yourself a little by getting it to do more than one thing, but that never goes up as fast as the number of transistors in the thing do, so you always lose by making bigger blocks. So, as you make the blocks bigger, the wires in them are longer, the number of transistors hooked to the wires are larger, so when you switch a wire, it costs a lot more energy. The combination of those two things means as you make bigger blocks, the amount of computation you get back for a given amount of energy goes down. Now, because you made the block bigger, it's a bigger fraction of your system. So to get a certain amount of work done, you have to run it faster. Running it faster means that you compound the felony by being way off optimum in terms of the amount of logic it can do per unit energy. So now you've got a triple play, but it's a different triple play than we heard. You've lost in the number of transistors you can switch. You've lost because you're driving more things than you're able to use, and that takes energy. And you've lost because you're trying to switch them much faster than an optimum would be. So you can just work it out yourself as you subdivide the computation into smaller and smaller blocks. You get more and more effective use of energy. So in this article, I said that the most telling cost of computation is the energy per logic event or computation event. And by that, I didn't mean an x86 instruction. I meant something which had an outcome, like switching a gate or getting a bit out of memory or something like that. So that was an interesting thing, because at the time, I would go around and give this talk, and universally, everybody said, that is the silliest thing I've ever heard. You're talking about making these ubiquitous devices, they plug into all, and nobody cares if they take 1 watt or 10 watts. And that was sort of the mentality of the industry up till maybe 10 years ago when Telecosm started. And even then, you didn't hear much except battery life. That was a sort of the placeholder for why power was bad. Well, at this Telecosm, it was very interesting. And I had actually got a little preview from one of my friends at Google who said, you know, the problem we're having with these data centers, all the power and all the heat and all that stuff. Now, you know, they locate them next to Bonneville, so they have, you know, adequate power supply. So it's not exactly like this is the first thing you'd think of as a power-sensitive computing application, but it is. So those are kind of the two extremes. Interesting. So I thought I'd tell you another story about a power-sensitive computing system. It's a system that's in production today. The system fits on a chip that's about a half a millimeter on a side, just about the size of a grain of sand. It's a complete digital radio. Has a receiver, transmitter, and a bunch of digital logic, and non-volatile memory. It's an autonomous system, and the reason it's power sensitive is it has to get its entire power supply from its antenna, from the base station. And it has to do some relatively sophisticated protocols because it's living in an environment where there's a base station or maybe more than one base station and hundreds of these little radios, and it has to know when to transmit and when to shut up and let somebody else talk and all of this. So this sophisticated little digital radio does its entire job on 5 microwatts. These are devices that are in current production. They're the company I'm involved with is Impinj, and they sort of pioneered the particular standard that's now a worldwide standard for these things. These are RFID chips that are used on the supply side. We heard the supply chain. They're used for pharmaceuticals to identify a particular individual pharmaceutical vials. It's a widely applicable system. So as you think about that, it's interesting. They're being sold in 100 million quantities. The company has a backlog of close to a billion units. And these are complete systems on a chip. They sell for a nickel. And they take 5 microwatts. So if you scale those devices, you get a power density that's about 1/10,000th of the power density that a typical microprocessor has. That is power per unit area. So those are kind of two extremes of systems, both of which are limited by the energy per unit work that gets done. So that's interesting. It's interesting that at about the same time, there would emerge these incredible extreme examples, both limited by the same physical quantity. So that's interesting. Meanwhile, of course, we're very proud of ourselves that we are able to accomplish these great technological marvels, and you all should be. I mean, it's just amazing. I was particularly taken by the emphasis in this microcosm on healthcare. It's sort of the one really important thing to all of us that is doesn't scale nearly as well as the other things we come across. And there are lots of reasons for that, and you heard all about that. I'm particularly fond of Art's vision of the little box you have hooked up to your PC that you can monitor the really important things about your health yourself, because that isn't illegal yet. So that was, I thought, a wonderful insight. I'm going to talk more with Art and try to get set up to do that. Interesting. The two examples that I talked about, the Google data center and the RFID spec, are sort of opposite extremes in the sense that we have this centralization going on. It was a topic of one of the discussions here. And then we have this distributed data. Here are these things which have non-volatile memory on them. They have to be non-volatile because they don't have a power supply most of the time, only when they get within range of a base station. So that's an interesting, I would guess before too long, the amount of data out in those things is going to start being on the scale with the amount of data in other things. And that's a different kind of world than we've seen before. And how do you think about a world where each individual thing down to the size of a grain of sand carries its own information with it, its history? It's a little more like living systems than it is like big central Big Brother things. Interesting. How do you think about that? How does that fit in with our now very well-defined view of what computation is and what information is and so forth? Interesting. That thing's going to take on a life of its own, obviously. And the only other things we know that are anything like that are life forms. I mean, there are ants and flies and bacteria and things that carry information with them and process that information and whatever. And now, these things I'm talking about are more passive than flies and even bacteria, but they're still autonomous in a way that we're not used to. So that's interesting. So now we're in a world where we've got yada bytes and yada ops, and we're all very proud of that, but it's still true. By the way, I've said this sort of every year for the last 10 years, that with all of our yada yadas, we can't do the computation that's done by a common housefly. I mean, the DARPA Grand Challenge, which filled up an entire van with computing stuff of the latest sort, was pathetic compared with a housefly. I mean, the housefly, for those of you who have tried to kill them, they're not so easy to get rid of, and they find food and escape predators and find mates and do all the things that pretty much any life form does. And you may think they're stupid, but it's not nearly as stupid as our computers. So that's kind of it. And they do all that on a few milliwatts. Some of you have heard me say some things about this before, but let me just say a little more about it. When you think of this trend that I mentioned, of if you really want more bang for a given bit of energy, if you really want to get more information processed for a given amount of energy, which I still believe is the real metric of goodness in this world, then what do? Well, we just thought that through, and what you do is you divide the computation into more and more parallel things that go slower. You don't try to make each one go faster. You just put lots and lots of them in parallel. Well, actually, we don't know how to do that. We've got now this multi-threaded thing going, and I think that's a really neat thing, because in that, there's this notion of sort of independence, which is a really, really nice notion. So let's suppose we were going to take that to its logical extreme for problems like the ones faced by a common housefly. They have to be able to see their surroundings. They have to be able to do command and control on a motor system, and let's just stop at that. That's pretty good. Well, one of the things we know is that set of things that the housefly has to do involves lots more inputs than we're used to. we're used to systems where there are not very many inputs, and we can rely pretty much on the inputs we get. You may have to correct them a little bit, but that may be a factor of two or whatever. The fly doesn't face that problem in that form. Lots and lots of inputs, and you never know which ones are going to be significant and which ones are just random. That's sort of the essence of a visual recognition problem. For those of us who've tried to solve visual recognition problems, and I've broken not just my pick, but my hoe and rake and everything else on those, it's a hard problem. And you get this funny feeling that with our digital technology going over, you know, kilo, mega, tera, whatever they are, yadas, we're so proud of that exponential that it sometimes escapes our notice that our ability to solve these problems that are easy for the housefly hasn't changed very much. If you read the old artificial intelligence literature, Marvin Minsky and those people of, 30 years ago, they were confident that with just another factor of 10, these would fall. Well, that was many, many factors of 10 ago. And we're doing a little better, a little bit, but not really very much. And you get the very distinct feeling that you're up against a problem that's sort of going up exponentially or of some very high power, and you're pushing on it with this thing. So you've got an exponential, trying to climb an exponential, and you're getting back maybe at most some kind of linear progress. Interesting. So what is it about that goo in the brain of a fly that can do that? And here we got all of our yada yadas, and we still haven't been able to do it. Well, we don't know, but let me just follow with me along a line of thought. So we start out with a bacteria, something like that. There's a wonderful, wonderful little book some of you have read called Five Clues to the Origin of Life. If you haven't read it, I'd strongly recommend it. It talks about, you know, what must have happened before we had DNA, because you can't just start with DNA because it's already a big high-tech solution. It's like saying, well, we started an information processing, you just go to your silicon fab. Where did a silicon fab come from? Okay, so it's a little like that. So we didn't start with DNA. There was some stuff behind it, and he has a bunch of theories about that. So that's not what I want to talk about. But the single-celled animals had DNA, and they were able to replicate that way. And they had extremely impoverished sensory systems. They could sense gradients in chemical density, so they could tumble around and on average swim towards where there's more stuff. They could sense gradients in light, so they could on average swim for the light. And that was kind of where it started. The signals were sent around by molecules diffusing, because when you have something small enough, diffusion is a very fast process. When things are small, it's an impossibly slow process as things get bigger. So it was fine for single-celled animals. So then the life forms started getting more complicated. And as they got more complicated, they needed to get signals from point A to point B faster than diffusion could take them. So there's an invention was called the neuron. And it was just a tube of thin membrane that had certain kinds of molecules in it that would make it have a negative resistance. So if you put a signal in one end, it would just kick in and would send a signal down to the other end. And that was the beginning of the simplest nervous systems. And then we started seeing these neuron devices getting more sophisticated. They got more and more inputs, and they started having more and more outputs. And so they started getting to be more complex and bigger. And these are very interesting things. They're made out of salt water and fat. You use fat for the insulator, and you use salt water for the conductor. Fat isn't a really good insulator, and salt water is a lousy conductor. So these are really very poor devices. The active devices, the thing that's, that make the device have gain, are molecules that punch little holes in the sides of the membrane. And what causes them to punch little holes and let current go through the side of the membrane are various things. The voltage on the membrane is one such thing. That's what made the signal go down the axon. There are other things. There are molecules that when light hits them, they'll let a signal go through the membrane. But there are far more molecules that go through the membrane depending upon another molecule. And it's a characteristic of organic chemistry that you can build incredibly specific lock and key-like pairs which have a specificity that's just amazing. And the more we learn about the nervous system, the more we find out that a whole lot of the information is carried by that kind of encoding, not just the electrical signals. And in fact, it's much richer space because electrical voltage on a neuron, there's a part which is, roughly speaking, analog, which sort of aggregates the inputs together, and I'll talk more about that. And then there's a part that sends that information to far parts of the brain. And that information that's sent to far parts of the brain is analog in time and digital in amplitude. So it's just a pulse, and it's the arrival time of the pulse that carries the information. So as this mechanism evolved, the neurons got bigger and more complex and bigger and more complex, and in the human cortex, those neurons have the input stuff. It's a big tree, which is a fraction of a millimeter long, has thousands of inputs, not millions, not tens, few thousand inputs, and one output. Sometimes a few local outputs and one long distance output. And the whole brain's made out of that sort of mechanism. So you can ask yourself, that's odd. Here's a mechanism, technology, that can make information-carrying things the size of a small molecule, and does, and uses them to enormous advantage in the nervous system. This is a very small thing carrying a lot of bits. Extreme examples are things like DNA where they string them all together, but in the nervous system, it's small molecules, much smaller than the DNA strand, and carrying extremely specific signals and interacting with each other in extremely specific ways. And then there's this electrical thing in the middle of it. And the electrical thing isn't just sending a signal from one part of the brain to the other fast, which it does fast by neural standards. That isn't the only thing it's there for, because they all have these big trees of inputs up on the tips of the tree, and then it funnels all the stuff down, and then at the end, it puts out a pulse. Interesting. As you're driving down a dark road on a dark night, you often make decisions as to which way to steer or whether to brake or not on the basis of a few dozen of those nerve pulses. When you're in a room like this, you get lots of them. And when you have a television image that's, you know, all set up for you, you get a system that works with lots and lots of pulses in such such a way that it's sort of like the rate at which pulses coming in is something like an analog signal. So here's a system that goes over this enormous dynamic range of information coming in, is able to make intelligent decisions over that entire range in such a way that we're not really very aware of what a huge dynamic range it is. I mean, when we're driving down we sort of think it's a little hard to see, but we're not aware that we're processing information in a completely different way than we do when we're watching a television that's nice and bright and we get lots of visible input. That's a different kind of system than we engineers have ever built. So as you think about this, you think, well, why didn't it just go ahead and do it with the small molecules? It's got lots of information there, and you can combine them in any way, you can combine them any other way, and does. But then it uses those to go into this electrical thing. Well, you could see, yeah, it's a fast way to get it from point A to point B. But then you wouldn't aggregate thousands of these little input devices that take combinations of those small molecules. And so it has an electrical signal coming in, turn it into small molecules, interact with other small molecules carrying all kinds of modulatory signals and things, and then dump it into this big tree of stuff. And then you put out a pulse at the end. We don't have any engineering device, system, or conception that works anything like that. Just no idea. But a very few of those in the brain of a fly allow it to do things that we can't do with all our yada, yada, yadas. So let me just put something out for you. Suppose it were true. Suppose it were true that what's happening up there, by the way, I happen to believe this, or otherwise I wouldn't be sharing it with you, that here you have individual inputs coming in, and it's known that those individual inputs make what's called, you know, everybody has their jargon. They're called EPSPs, excitatory postsynaptic potentials. They're little tiny pulses that are much, much smaller than a nerve pulse. And it used to be thought, when I first started doing neuroscience, that this big tree was made out of salt water, and it had these thin membranes, which are capacitive, so you have a resistor, capacitor, that's a sure way to diffuse out your information and just get it to all be just averaged. So it was thought that all the information came in here and you just average it all together, and when you got above a threshold, the nerve would fire. That was the model people had of neurons. And many of these insane statements you hear made on pundits on television and so forth about how little there is going on in the brain, have that model of what's going on there. Well, I would submit to you that if that were what were going on there, that wouldn't have been the device that were evolved, because it wouldn't be good for anything. You could do better just using the molecules. You didn't have to turn them into anything electrical to get this kind of a mush out of it. You can do that with chemical concentrations just as fast. So you wouldn't do that. So why is it going to all this trouble? Why does it grow this big thing and support it with... Well, then it was found out soon after I got into neuroscience that somebody had the presence of mind to stimulate way out there and sending nerve pulses into the tips of this thing and actually look at what's coming down instead of just theorizing. And guess what? They didn't turn into mush. They stayed just the same width as when they went in at the top. Oops. That's not exactly the property of a resistor capacitor, which turns everything into a broader and broader and broader pulse. No, that's not what's going on. So supposing what's true up there is that these pulses come in, and the decision that neuron has to make is there some meaningful pattern here? Which means that nerve pulses coming in with certain time delays between each other have extracted some sort of meaningful information out of the input scene, for example. Now, if that was true, you'd never know which ones would come in because you have a sparse image. You don't know where George's face is going to be. But there are patterns in it, and the patterns are relative patterns, and they're encoded in the nervous system in the relative time of arrival of nerve pulses. And that can be decoded by the relative distance one of these little tiny potentials has to go before it gets to where the next one comes in. So already you can see the makings of something powerful here. Because if those little pulses, when they come together, interact non-linearly, now the random ones will just come down and they'll be just little bitty things, but the ones that have the right time delays between them will interact non-linear and they'll get bigger, and the next time that happens, they'll get exponentially bigger. And I would submit to you that this is the makings of a device whose ability to extract information is exponential in its size. Now, we've never had a thing like that. There's one posited right now in the computer science / physics literature. It's called quantum computer. There isn't any physical realization of one of these, but there's a mathematical model, and this is basically a quantum system whose wave function evolves freely with time. You mix together different parts of the wave function and it evolves in time, and it sweeps out an exponential amount of state space. And then if you find some way to stop it at exactly the right time and find out what state it's in, that once you've posited that mechanism, you can show that that's exponential in the size of the thing. Well, back in the old days, when computer science was first formulated, and to this day in most ways that it's presented, it's always assumed that the computation ability of a structure goes sort of not much more than linearly with the size of the structure. Maybe a little bit, maybe not. I've made a pretty good case to you today that our current capabilities are going less than linearly with the size of things we're making, and that we need to do more parallelism. Well, here we have a thing where in the nervous system, in my mind almost certainly, we have a structure whose capability goes up exponentially or at some very high power of the size of the structure. That would make it worthwhile to do this electrical to chemical to electrical conversion and all of that nonsense, because it's just extraordinarily powerful computational device. We don't know that that's true. I have not been able to prove it. But it's conceivable. Now, suppose that were, in fact, the case. There's nothing about the physics of goo that works with ions and membranes that can't work with electrons and insulators. There's no reason, if we ever understood what this absolutely fantastic, remarkable structure is doing, that we can't learn from it and develop a computational paradigm which is completely different than anything that we know or have even imagined. That's what got me into neuroscience. Because in the end, we have to make more and more parallel systems. The degree of parallelism is, in the end, going to be the efficacy of our information processing systems. And here is a working system which has sort of the ultimate parallelism. So as we look at the second decade of the telecosm, I would submit to you that we're not really burned out. I think there's plenty to think about. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Carver, and thank you, Mary, and all the people who made this thing, this event possible, from Forbes and from the audio people and the whole array of massively parallel efforts that concluded with the 10th telecosm. Thank you all and good night.
The sign. We'd like as many people as possible to hang around and sign it if they could. Thank you.
Can there be another musical performance tonight? A lot of people.